Welcome to Transforming NATO, a podcast exploring how NATO is refining its edge in a rapidly changing world. This series is brought to you by ACT, NATO's Allied Command Transformation. ACT is transforming NATO to ensure that the world's most successful alliance stays ready to meet the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Hi, I'm Kathy Lewis, and today we're talking about resilience in the NATO alliance and the work that Allied Command Transformation is doing to ensure that the alliance is strong today and better tomorrow. Two guests joining us today. We're talking with Captain Jack Benfield. He's the team lead for concept development here at ACT. And in that role, he is working on a concept called layered resilience. We're also happy to have Tony Ikean, who's a concept developer and experimenter at HubZone HQ, which is a defense contractor supporting the layered resilience team here at ACT. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you bet. This concept of resilience is really an interesting one, and it's changed over time. Captain Benfield, I know that we had a concept of resilience in the post-Cold War period. What'd that look like?
You're correct. So actually, resilience has been a part of NATO from the very beginning. With the North Atlantic Treaty that founded NATO, Article 3 talks about resilience and how it's individual nations' responsibility, but of collective interest to the alliance, because we're only as strong as the nations within our alliance. And so for a long time during the Cold War, that focused primarily on the military's ability to respond to shocks. That was making their own power, making their own water, transporting their own goods, even making some of their own goods in foundries and factories. Post-Cold War, that really changed. With the fall of the Soviet Union, we really started to focus on the ability to support civil society and crisis management and response. There has been a large focus since then on civil preparedness, and it's been very, very fruitful and productive. But now, post-2014, with Russia's invasion of Crimea, it was now military's back in the discussion. And so the strategies are shifting, long-term thought is shifting, and so we're trying to bring the military resilience back into the discussion. Not that it's ever been fully forgotten, but placing renewed emphasis and thought about what that really needs to look like to best position the alliance.
But it really is, it sounds like, both of those entities, both of those fields of influence are present in this discussion, the military and the civilian sector.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. We're stronger if we're more resilient, and we're more resilient if we're resilient on the civil side and on the military side, because really, they're the same side. We're one alliance, and so it's making sure that all aspects of the alliance are resilient.
You've mentioned the Russian invasion of Crimea, and if we look at the challenges and changes that have happened in recent years, you really see this resurgence of a hybrid warfare scenario where it's not just about tanks and airplanes and all the rest of it, but it really is coming from places that we sort of can't control to some extent.
Absolutely. A story I like to use is when I was commissioned back in 2000, I was handed a book that was network-centric warfare. And I had never heard of it. I had never known what it was, and I couldn't even tell you who handed it to me. But obviously they were a very smart person, because it's everything now is so networked and so integrated that it's more efficient and effective for us to operate in that way. We're able to respond quicker, respond more effectively. It also introduces more potential vulnerabilities. And so if there is an actor out there that wants to influence us negatively, there's more ways for them to get in, whether it's any physical operations below the kind of the threshold of conflict, or whether it's doing a networked attack in cyber or in space. All these things that make life better today reduce potential or introduce potential vulnerabilities. And so we see a lot of that. And then you put on top of that disinformation, FIMI campaigns, foreign information manipulation campaigns, where they can introduce a narrative where it doesn't even have to be true, but they introduce a narrative and it can spread very quickly. It can go viral. And all of a sudden now people are questioning what normally they would not have questioned. And while questions are always good, they take time to answer.
Sure. And then AI on top of that, when you get into the disinformation space.
AI just accelerates the whole thing. It makes it happen so much faster.
I noticed that you're working on this layered resilience as a concept and not on the doctrine, as a doctrine. And I know the military is very big on doctrines. So what makes this a concept and not a doctrine? So maybe walk through the difference between those two.
So really, I'll give a quick example. I like to speak in allegory, but then I'll like to turn it over to Tony for the nuts and bolts. But really, we're trying to give the nations, because it's an individual responsibility as per Article 3, we're trying to give them a guide. We're giving them the handrail. We're not building the steps to climb the resilience ladder. We're giving them a handrail. Things to consider. It's there if they want to use it. It's there for them to use however they choose to use. We're not dictating to them as doctrine would.
Oh, that's interesting.
To make it simple, concepts are used to either fill a military gap, a gap in knowledge, or to improve a way that we do things today. Therefore, concepts are focused on the future. Doctrine, in contrast, is focused on present day forces, and it's basically telling you how to do things. Concepts focus on the what, while doctrine focuses on the how.
That is a really good explanation. Thank you for that. We think the other place where I think that's really critical to this conversation is the difference between capability and capacity. Yes. Can you distinguish those for us?
Yeah, I mean, once again, we can talk forever about these things, but in the most simplest terms, a lot of times when we're talking about capabilities, although capabilities include a wide range of things, but normally when people talk about capability, they're talking about technology. When we're saying, okay, we need to enhance our capability, we need to improve our technology. And that's one way to create a military force, is to be the most high-tech force in the world. You can win just based on your high-tech. The problem with high technology and capability focus is it's very expensive. Not a lot of people can do it. And in general, it's not as sustainable. So for the amount of money I can spend to buy, for example, one F-35, I may be able to buy several other fighters that are less expensive. So then you're like, okay, do I want to have a small number of very high-capable things, or larger numbers of lower capability? And then when we're talking about capacity, normally it's sheer numbers is normally when we're talking about it. So whenever you're building a force, really what you need is a balance. You need a balance of high tech, but does everything that you own have to be the latest and greatest? The reality is no. And if we look at the war in Ukraine right now, a lot of things that's getting in the press is, oh, you know, we've got all these precision-guided munitions, the HIMARS, all these things are in the press. But when you look at what's actually being used, for the most part, it's actually lower cost, just our basic artillery supported by, you know, commercial off-the-shelf targeting through, you know, drones, not very high-tech things. So you can use capacity, so large numbers of lower-tech things, to make up for the lack of high-tech capability. And this is a balance that when you're generating your military force, you need to figure out what is the proper balance to create the military force and to get the effects, because that's really what matters, is what effect do I want to have in the battlefield? And you can either achieve that through high tech or low tech or combination thereof.
This seems to be a really important concept when you're talking about a collective defense organization that includes nations of varying budgets, varying sizes, varying capabilities.
It's and also just varying degrees with which they want to get involved in these operations. It's a voluntary organization. So having these ideas and then allowing the nations to see, one, how they want to implement them within their own nation, and then also how they want to integrate into the alliance and what they can offer and bring to the fight, or the future fight or the potential fight, is really the important part. It allows them, and that's why we're doing this concept, is allows them to find or consider different ways to allow their force to be integrated in the future. Mm. Because we are a future-focused concept. We're looking 20-plus years out.
Is that part of this assessment tool?
It is. And so one of the things that we're working on is a military resilience risk assessment. And it's a question-based assessment looking at how the concept that we're developing is implemented into a nation's processes, procedures, and how they design that future force. Because resilience, it's not fast to build, it's not cheap to build, and it's not easy to build. What we can do to help these nations make sure that they're taking this into consideration is give them this question-based assessment that really looks at their force design, force development, force generation processes and procedures. Do they take the principles that we describe in our concept into account? And if so, are there actionable steps? Are they integrated? Because interoperability is a big part of this, both within their own nation for joint operations and then in the coalition together. And so do they take these ideas and these concepts that we describe into account as they are looking at what their future force looks like?
You know, it strikes me that we have, I think many people understand the definition or the concept of resilience. It strikes me that we sometimes, as individuals, think about it as hardening ourselves against the thing that just happened, right? So if we're, and I'm just, this is not a great example, but if we're thinking about airplane safety and now we're taking our shoes off, you know what I mean? We're sort of really focused on the last thing that happened. And it strikes me that this concept really has to do with understanding that we're not going to solve it. We're just going to be prepared for it and better able to adapt.
You're definitely right. What we talk about, we're guarding or being more resilient about, it's not events. It's, we just call them shocks. And if you look at what a shock is something you don't see coming. You may have a little bit of indications and warnings that something's going to happen, but it's not something that you see. And that's why it catches you off guard. And that's really what can harm your resilience or your readiness. Mm. And so being able to, whether it's a man-made shock like an attack, or it's a natural shock like climate change or like severe weather or anything like that. And so really it is what we do to make sure that everybody is thinking about the future and then thinking about those, not necessarily a black swan event or a pink elephant event, but really one that is a possibility, but not probable, because those are the ones that are going to catch you off guard.
That's a big balancing act, isn't it? Between preparing for the things you're pretty sure could happen based on a set of criteria, and that's part of what we've discussed in our other episodes in the series, is preparing for the thing that based on trends and all of the rest of it, we're pretty sure this could happen. But then you also have to be prepared for these things that sort of hit you from left field. There's a tendency in public discourse, it seems, to look at a shock that happens to the system and say, well, we weren't prepared for that. And so that's a failure because we weren't prepared for it. It sounds like what you're asking us to do at some level is to change the whole way we think about these things and the responses to them, and to reevaluate the relative success or failure of how we respond to shocks and changes.
Yes, that's definitely part of it. And it's the first three kind of steps or gates that we ask or describe in our concept are anticipate, adapt, and prepare for shocks. So it's just having that deliberate thought process, however formalized it may be, about what could happen and what the impact could be. And then being able to say, okay, well, if that happens, how can we adapt our force, what we have now? Because it can be an incremental build, because resilience is not so much an end state where you cross the finish line and say, okay, I am now resilient. It's a process, and it's a continuous process. And so it's adapting the force and then practice and rehearsal about what we do, because when a crisis happens, whatever you're trained to, that's how you're going to respond. And so doing that training and that preparation. And if you can do that, then you can be an effective force that can have a degree of deterrence for the alliance and allow them to be a credible force that where, even despite of a shock that may happen or something you may not see coming, they can respond to it. Because that's really what we're trying to influence, is you can't prepare for everything. Everybody is resource constrained. It's not physically possible. But you can be prepared to respond when something's happened.
So in terms of the public approach to this, it sounds like we would be better as individuals to think about the response to a shock as opposed to anything else. We should really be looking at the response, because these things are going to happen.
Yes, absolutely. And there are a number of nations within our alliance that do that to a certain degree. A lot of the Nordic countries, a lot of the Baltic countries, and a lot of other countries in the alliance, they have what they call a total defense concept or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's talking to the individual level, the individual civilian level, about here's what the military is going to do, here's what the civil government is going to do, here's what we expect you to do. Some nations have a checklist of, in your 72-hour go bag in the event of a problem or a crisis. Here's what you should have at the ready to then, and here's what we expect you to do. So there's a lot of messaging in a lot of countries already, and we're not saying that works for everybody, but that's one way to do it. And so it's those considerations and that having those discussions, because again, it's all about preparing. And so you'd need to think about it ahead of time, that the time to come up with a plan is not during the crisis.
Right. It's interesting too, to think about this as an individual responsibility.
And we talk about resilience as a whole society issue, and Jack was mentioning that with the total defense concept. But if we personalize this, which is how I like to do it, think about a hurricane hitting the Hampton Roads area where we're at. If people are personally resilient, where, you know, they have, you know, as we said, make sure you have enough food and water to last you maybe a couple weeks and your medications and all this. When an event happens, when a shock happens, then the response of the government doesn't have to address every single individual in society, because they can't. They're not capable. So they can focus on those people that are not able to take care of themselves or the ones that were hit specifically. And therefore, they can, you know, it's kind of triage. I can focus on them. So what we're doing as a society to make our whole nation resilient is saying, okay, look, I'm going to be able to take care of myself, at least initially, and that's how I contribute overall to national resilience. So now you're just building this. Now you add the city level, you add the state level, all the way up to, you know, the highest levels of government. And we need to look at resilience that way.
It seems like that's something that harkens back to older times. I mean, I'm thinking in World War II, we were very accustomed, I think the whole world was accustomed to that concept of being part of the effort, taking responsibility for yourself, contributing where you could. But we've got a couple of generations away from that. And so it's not necessarily a part of our collective global memory in quite the same way.
I think you're correct, but I think that if we do look, there are still examples today that we can take into account and learn from. And it can be both a military operation or just a natural strategic shock. The obvious one is the COVID pandemic. There were a number of examples where the military and civil society came together to distribute aid, goods, vaccines to the population at large. And it was a great example of military support to civil society, which is one of the things we're working on. And working together, we were able to generate, produce, and distribute medicine, goods in a very quick way and in a fairly efficient way as well. Always room for improvement, but it's unprecedented in recent history.
It's a great point, yeah. And then I'm thinking too about if you look at what's going on in Ukraine right now,
absolutely,
with that combination of the people supporting the effort.
Absolutely. Now, the Ukrainian military is engaged in combat with Russian forces, and civil society is finding new, unique, and novel ways to assist their military, whether it's through spotting, reporting, flying drones, or even taking commercial assets and weaponizing them. There are a lot of different aspects in which that they can, one, they've withstood already almost 2 years of conflict. They've been able to keep the trains running on time. They've been able to keep the lights on. Shortly after attack, they come right back on again. They've kept essential health and services going. Kids are in school. It's amazing how resilient that society is. And it takes everybody in that entire society pulling in the same direction to do so.
Yeah. That, it seems to me, is the big challenge moving forward, right? To engage everyone in that.
As Jack mentioned, after the Cold War, we kind of got away from this resilience mindset. And it's very evident in the logistics area, where, you know, before we used to have large stockpiles and, you know, we could last. But then after the Cold War, we went to this mentality of let's make things more efficient, you know, make more money, just-in-time logistics. So we just have enough stuff on the shelves to last us until the next shipment comes in. But we can't depend on that anymore. And that's what we're seeing, is that we don't have the stockpiles that we did years ago to make up. Because what happens if we can't? Our transportation systems come down, or we don't get those chips from Taiwan.
We've also discovered recently,
correct,
right?
Yeah. But that's because we went into an efficiency model, while resilience, as Jack said, doesn't necessarily mean you're efficient.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to build some inefficiencies in order to be resilient, and you got to build up those stockpiles. It's like I buy insurance. Is that really efficient? Well, if I don't need it, then yeah, it's not very efficient. But when I need it, it's there, right? So it's just one of those things you have to invest in yourself to be resilient.
Yeah, that's Tony Ikaya, and he's a concept developer and experimenter at HubZone HQ, which is a defense contractor that is supporting the layered resilience team here at Allied Command Transformation, and that is led by Captain Jack Benfield, who's the team lead for concept development. If I understand this correctly, this group that's dealing with layered resilience, this is your focus. This is the only team that's fully kind of dedicated to this concept. Did I have that right?
You do. We have the luxury of, this is our day job. It's a team of four, including the two of us here at Allied Command Transformation, that we are charged with developing the layered resilience warfare development imperative out of the NATO warfighting capstone concept. And then we can't do it alone, though, because as we've discussed, this is a very large concept and large situation to tackle. And so what we've done is we've gone out to all of the allies and solicited their support, because we're taking a look thematically throughout the military. And so we've got seven thematic areas that each military has to be resilient. We feel each military has to be resilient in. And so we have seven nations that have agreed to lead these thematic areas. And what they do is they build a community of interest from within their nation, with other nations, partner nations, industry, and academia. And then they explore and develop their contribution to the concept for each of those areas. And then that will then marry in with the core concept, which is what we're developing, and produce the final document.
That's fascinating, because you'll get an experience that is so wide-ranging, and in some cases, of course, specifically appropriate to that nation. You get that. But there's some of these concepts that you could easily see elevating in other places, particularly the Nordic concepts of being really clear about what as individuals we should be willing and able to do. It takes time to get there, but that's a real mind shift for some nations in policy. So that's a very interesting perspective. As you think about those Nordic nations, what influences that, I guess, is my question, because it seems like a pretty logical concept that we all have a role to play, so let's play that role. And you said, I think, Captain Benfield, that they're prepared for a couple of weeks to have food and water and whatnot. In the United States, it's difficult to get people to think about 3 days of preparation. That's the goal now of some of the emergency planners, is 3 days. How do you do that?
So part of that is the experience of that nation. So, and also proximity to a perceived threat. Those Nordic nations, very close to Russia, which they perceive as a potential threat. And so it's easier to have that conversation, because there's this shared understanding that there could be a potential enemy right at our borders already. So that allows them to focus on having those 72-hour go bags, or integrating with civil society, or here's my day job, but then here's what I do in the event of a crisis. I report to be an auxiliary fire brigade, or whatever it might be. Whereas over in the U.S., during the pandemic, we're fighting about toilet paper. And it's not to say that one is better than the other, but it's a product of the experience. We've had the luxury of not having to think about worries about supply and demand and what's out there. You see it a little bit on the East Coast during hurricane season or in the winter, but it's milk, bread, and eggs to make their blizzard French toast. It's not something that we prepare for. And that's why there's always that rush. And so the further out you can think, the further out you can plan, the more resilient you are automatically making yourself. And then you can just continue to develop from there.
I love this concept, because there's something in it for every one of us, right? There's something in it, obviously, for the military piece of this. The critical nature of civilian support is really key. So I want to thank both of you for joining us today. What an interesting conversation about not just the military aspect of this, but the idea that all of us have a role to play. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us for this conversation about layered resilience with Captain Jack Benfield, who leads development on a concept called layered resilience. That'll be critical as NATO prepares for a complex and interconnected future. And we've also been talking with Tony Ikaian, who's a concept developer and experimenter at HubZone HQ, which is a defense contractor supporting the layered resilience team here at Allied Command Transformation. That's it for this edition of Transforming NATO, a podcast exploring how NATO is refining its edge in a rapidly changing world. This series is brought to you by ACT, NATO's Allied Command Transformation. You can learn more about ACT at act.nato.int. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.